It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is expected to change its limits on aggregate campaign donations after a court appearance by state election officials yesterday.
First, according to new numbers released this week, poverty in Wisconsin has gone down a bit since the Great Recession, but still hasn't returned to pre-crash levels. We talked to that report's author yesterday on the show.
Now we take a closer look at families and parents in poverty. Our next guest has studied poverty and families living in poverty for years with a focus on low-income parents. And along the way, she has tried to correct public misperceptions about those parents.
Catherine Eden is with us now. She's a professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Her books include Promises I Can Keep, Why Poor Women Put Motherhood Before Marriage. And most recently, she's the co-author of Doing the Best I Can, Fathering in the Inner City. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, a lot of sociologists study things like poverty through the lens of statistics and surveys. They don't always sort of live with the people they're researching. But you did that. You lived in the inner city neighborhoods in Camden, New Jersey for 3 years. Why was that important to you?
Well, at the time we started the study, there were all kinds of explanations for the spread of single parenthood. And none of them really held up to the statistical test. So single parenthood, as one of my colleagues said, was the biggest demographic mystery of the last half of the 20th century. And we thought that if we were going to, you know, get the answer right after other folks had struggled to do that we really needed to sort of take the extra step and move into a community where rates of single parenthood were high and see for ourselves what the dynamics of this community was like.
Well, when we hear a lot of the conversation, the national conversation about poverty, we hear the phrase deadbeat dads for one, and we hear about the rise of single mothers and the disintegration of the family. What did you reposition in your mind when you thought about those things from your new perspective?
Well, you know, I think what we used to think is that we had either stable two-parent families or we had single moms. And if you look at the demographic data, I mean, our ethnographic research revealed this, and then we were able to see documentation in representative, national representative data. What we find is that there really are no single mothers or very few single mothers, at least among women who give birth non-maritally. Instead, what you see is very complex families, mothers and fathers churning through partners. It's almost as if they're dating, just like college students are, but they're having children along the way. So the typical child in a single-parent family, first of all, is typically born to two parents who are together romantically. But then over the course of time, these children end up on a family go-round, experiencing a number of different parent transitions. You know, new men come into their mother's lives, new women come into their father's lives, and new siblings come in through both of those channels, creating very complex families.
And what is the effect of that on the children?
Well, the evidence is just coming in. You know, we sort of just discovered this sort of demographic reality. And from what we can tell, children are resilient. We know that children of divorce, for example, can recover after a year or two. But what's going on with non-marital children often, and, you know, in the United States, having children out of marriage is almost completely a phenomenon among the least educated and the least advantaged Americans. So we have to keep that in mind. The transitions happen so quickly that children can't recover. And what we're seeing is that children are not doing well, especially boys.
Well, when we talk about boys, we often, you know, look to the father. And looking at the fathers has been something that society's been doing for a while, saying, you know, these dads are not involved in the kids' life, and that is seems to be part of the problem in poverty-stricken neighborhoods. What do you hear when you talk to low-income fathers in Camden, New Jersey, in some of these poor neighborhoods?
Yeah, well, what we hear, we studied low-income dads in 23 neighborhoods across Camden and Philadelphia, and both black and white fathers. There are not a lot of Latinos in Philadelphia. And what we heard was very striking. First of all, there is a tremendous desire to father, to be a father, and not just to take on the status, but to really engage in the role. So we know now from representative data that, 98% of fathers arrive at the hospital when their baby is born, really wanted to be involved with that child. 80% of the time, they're in a romantic relationship with the mother. 75% of the time, they say, hey, there's a good chance we're going to stay together and even get married. So men have these high hopes, even these disadvantaged men, for really fathering their children. And what's really attracting them, I guess the irony to the story is, what's really attracting them to the relationship is actually the child. So in the old days, you know, in the 50s, right, men sort of had to be tied to their children through their relationship to their partner. But the partner relationship was really central, and the father-child relationship was more peripheral. For the men we studied, it was really the father-child relationship they saw as central. So when confronted with a surprise pregnancy, and most of these pregnancies were accidental, rather than cutting and running, they often rejoiced in the fact and really tried to get it together with the mother of their child in order to form a family-like relationship so they could stay involved.
So what you're saying kind of turns on its head common assumptions about poor dads and the role that they play in the family and in these city areas that are impoverished as well. How significant is it? Well, you're painting a sympathetic picture of dads who want to be involved, who are most excited about the child, and yet it doesn't turn out that way. But how significant is it?
Well, it doesn't turn out that way in part because the relationships weren't very stable in the first place. So the average time to first conception leading to a live birth is just 6 to 7 months. Most of the time, these couples aren't in what fathers would call a real relationship. They're kind of in a more casual relationship. And so getting it together, you know, sort of forming a relationship in the face of a non-marital birth, a surprise pregnancy, it actually proves really hard, especially when most of these men don't have the financial wherewithal to sort of support a family. So good intentions can still have tragic outcomes. I will say, though, that if you look at these dads representative data, we looked at the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, over time, they do tend to stay very, very involved in fathering. The problem is that they have their children across many different partners. If you have your children across more than one partner, which most of these men do, it's very hard to stay involved with sort of both sets of children. So what we see is that men are specializing, being very involved with one set of children, but often leaving an older child behind. So we call this serial selective fathering, and of course what this means for dads is they feel good about having accomplished fathering, but yet, you know, the children are left on a father go round. They may have a stepfather that engages in their life for a while, but the stepfather relationship tends to be just as fragile as the mother father relationship. And there's no one, you know, to pay the college tuition when the kid reaches 18.
We're talking right now with researcher Catherine Eden of Johns Hopkins University about the role of mothers and fathers in low-income families. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We continue our conversation about poverty, parenting, and misconceptions about low-income mothers and fathers. Sociologist Catherine Eden is with us.
And you can join the conversations with your questions for our guests or your thoughts and experiences. If you were or are a low-income parent, what are some of the challenges? And what do you think about current public policy when it comes to poverty relief? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk at WPR.org. And Catherine, we were talking about some of the different ways that fathers did finally parent the children that they wanted to have. Sometimes they focused it on one child. And I'm curious about what you think about the way that these fathers are treated by public policy, by the law.
Well, fathers are treated, I think, by society in general. These dads, right? Not middle-class dads who typically, get separated from their kids through divorce. But these dads, low-income dads, are treated as either paychecks or predators. A middle-class dad, when he divorces, when he's assigned a child support award, he gets visitation. And in most states, this is not true for non-marital dads. They get assigned a child support order, and they have to hire a lawyer and go to court in order to get any visitation. So they often call this taxation without representation. They really want to be a part of their kids' lives. They want to help guide their kids. They feel that they can really play a role. And so in some ways, they really rail against this notion of being treated as paychecks. Public policy often treats them as predators. Do we give them visitation? Maybe they're dangerous. Maybe they won't sort of stick with the child. But I think the fault in our thinking there is that we're imagining that the alternative to keeping dad involved is a stable single mother. But instead, what that child will experience is a series of father figures, none of whom will stick with the child. So do we keep bio-dad involved? Do we help strengthen bio-dad's parenting skills? Do we help him learn to be the best dad he can, which he desperately wants to be? It's just, I used to study single mothers for years prior to studying these dads, and I had no sympathy, for these men until I finally talked with them. But it's really quite striking how much they want to engage in this role. And instead of putting kids on a father-go-round, my advice would be to support dad in being the best parent he can be to his own child.
We're going to go to the phones right now and talk to Chris in Milwaukee, and you can join as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Chris, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How are you doing?
Pretty good. What do you think about all this?
Oh, I think I'm happy that you started studying dad. I forgot your name. I apologize. I just tuned in. I was like, wow, this is the exact situation I'm in now. And, the problem is I want to be a father. I want to be a family. But the mother, she's just, it's hard to explain, but she just doesn't want me involved at all. I'm trying to be a husband. Yes, I can. We had children before wedlock, but I found God, thankfully, and he definitely led me to becoming a better man, becoming a better father, and it's tough. And now I'm paying $1,140 a month in child support, getting $1,600 after taxes for me. I still take care of the kids, and I still spend money on the kids when I have them every weekend, except one when I'm on call working. And, it's tough. I just don't understand how society sees things. It boggles my mind. It really does. And unfortunately, I've been struggling with this for 9 months now, trying to make it work, and I just keep getting beat down. So, and there's fathers out there, a lot of fathers out there like that, and it's tough.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling, Chris, and sharing your experience and your thoughts. Appreciate that. And, Catherine, what goes through your mind as you hear Chris?
Chris, thanks for calling. This is such a common story. You know, moms are often trying to do the best they can with regard to their kids. They're protective. But the fact of the matter is gatekeeping is real. And where we see gatekeeping, you know, that's the mom keeping the dad away, is not only when dad can't afford to pay child support, which Chris is doing, but also when she enters into a new partnership. It turns out that it's, you know, hard to keep these new relationships together as parents are churning through partnerships. And, you know, when dad comes around to visit the kids and mom is trying to sort of forge a new family, there's often conflict. And so mom's often tempted, you know, to swap daddies. And in fact, moms often, you know, sort of over time attract better partners, at least in terms of their education and earnings. And so it can be really tempting to think, well, I was with this caterer who only worked half time. He wasn't that great. Now I'm with a mechanic. Wouldn't that be a better dad for my kids? But what moms are failing to appreciate is that, you know, the caterer is going to stick with that kid if given the chance, and the electrician, once the relationship breaks up, is long gone.
Now, marriage is one piece of the puzzle here that we haven't talked too much about, and one thing you looked at was the ways that women decide to get married or not to get married. What factors do women in poverty weigh when they're deciding whether or not to get married?
Well, both moms and dads value marriage. You know, the typical person surveyed at the time of a child's birth, whether it's the mom or the dad, is planning to get married to the partner. You know, we sometimes joke based on our research that it's not that the poor think too little of marriage, it's almost as if they think too much of marriage. So marriage is held to a very high standard among the poor. To get married and risk divorce is a sacrilege. And in fact, a poor but happy marriage is in some ways a sacrilege because of the risk of marital dissolution. Poor folks generally say that marriage is sacred. It's a sacred bond. And they don't think their relationships, and remember, these relationships are forged quickly and almost accidentally, are really up to the demands of marriage. We find that over time, if couples gain economic stability and their relationship quality is high, there's a greater chance that they will transition to marriage. But it's certainly not as though the poor don't value marriage. Both moms and dads say they want to get married and believe marriage is the right place to marry their kids, but they don't want to marry foolishly. And in that way, I think they're reflecting the values of the middle class. It's just that they've already gone ahead and had the kids.
Catherine, based on what you saw and you experienced, what kind of public policies do you think actually work to help people get out of poverty and support the families that they have?
Well, you know, family is both a cause. Family structure changes are both a cause and a consequence of poverty, right? Part of the reason the poor don't marry is because they can't afford to. They can't live up to the cultural standard of marriage. You know, marriage in the larger culture is viewed, you know, as sort of the frosting, as our respondents say, the frosting on the cake of a working class respectability already achieved. Our families want a little piece of the American pie. They want the white picket fence. And they don't believe it's appropriate to get married until they have those things so they can make sure their marriage will survive. So as economic inequality is increased and the fate of low-wage workers is just, you know, it's so very difficult, you know, the poor folks' chances of achieving even a modest level of stability have really declined in serious ways. So, you know, making sure low-wage workers can earn a family wage is, of course, critical. But more than that, we believe, my co-author Timothy Nelson and I believe that what we really need is a societal change of heart about these men. Beyond seeing them as predators or mere paychecks, we need to recognize their value as parents. I live in Baltimore, and Johns Hopkins University has adopted an inner city school. And in that school...
And we've got about 10 seconds. Sorry, just about out of time.
They invite fathers into every classroom. Fathers are on field trips. Fathers are on the emergency contact list. And it's just amazing how these dads are really engaging with their children and with their children's schools.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That was Catherine Eden, poverty researcher at Johns Hopkins University. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out how to get started foraging for spring edibles like morels and ramps.
First, though, last month the Supreme Court decided that aggregate campaign finance limits are not constitutional on grounds of free speech. That was a case of McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission.
In the wake of that decision, donors can donate as much as they like in any given election cycle overall. However, there are still restrictions on how much donors can give to one specific candidate.
That decision was made on the federal level, but Wisconsin state-specific campaign finance limits still stood. Yesterday, Wisconsin election officials acknowledged that in light of the McCutcheon decision last month, Wisconsin's limits can't be upheld. Here with us to talk about what this could mean for Wisconsin politics is Ken Mayer. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and an expert on campaign finance. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, so how inevitable was this moment once the Supreme Court ruled against overall campaign donation limits last month?
It was inevitable because Wisconsin has to abide by the national constitutional rulings. And once the court issued that decision in McCutcheon, it was just a matter of when officials here would acknowledge that the state limits, the aggregate limits, are similarly unconstitutional.
So was it a matter of election officials acknowledging that they had to follow these limits, or was it something that had to be brought via the court?
Well, the acknowledgement took place in the context of a lawsuit that had been filed last year by someone who had challenged the state aggregate limits. And what the GAB officials did yesterday was acknowledge in court that they would no longer be able to uphold or enforce those limits. So it was kind of an odd process in the sense that it wasn't the legislature, it wasn't a formal rulemaking process. It was just an acknowledgement that the state of the world had changed and they couldn't enforce them anymore.
Now, Wisconsin isn't the only state that had these limits. There are others out there. What are we seeing elsewhere in the nation about what's happening in the light of this ruling?
They'll fall everywhere. Now that we have this constitutional ruling from the Supreme Court, there is no state that will be able to enforce these aggregate limits. Now, there are also some states that don't have aggregate limits or that have much looser regulations. They won't be affected.
Now, Fred Young Jr. was the one involved in this case that we're talking about, and it hasn't been settled yet, but can you talk about what that case was and what's at stake there specifically?
Well, as I understand it, it was similar to what McCutcheon was arguing at the federal level. It was a lawsuit that was alleging that the aggregate caps, which in Wisconsin were actually much stricter than at the federal level, there was a $10,000 limit here as opposed to what amounted to about a $45,000 limit to federal candidates from individuals. So it was parallel litigation, and it was just a matter of time once the McCutcheon decision came down.
Now, Fred Young Jr. has said he sees a more educated, a more engaged electorate coming from this decision. What do opponents see?
Well, if you talk to campaign reform groups like the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, they see this as another way for wealthy people to have disproportionate influence in elections. And so you balance the individual right to be able to contribute. There's a First Amendment right at stake there versus a general concern about the nature of influence and corruption. Now, where it gets a little difficult is that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has consistently held that influence, or a concern that certain groups or certain people will have too much influence, is not a consideration. That the only justification for these kinds of limits is preventing, as they put it, corruption or the appearance of corruption. And so when you think about it in terms of certain groups having more or less influence, there are arguments that you can make about the consequences, but as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, those don't carry any weight.
How do you see this affecting donations to specific parties, a.k.a. the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, or political action committees?
Well, what's going to happen is you will see a relatively small number of people make more individual contributions to candidates. And it's worth stressing that those contribution limits, which are $500 for state assembly, $1,000 for a Senate state senator, and up to $10,000 for statewide candidates, those contribution limits remain in force. But now an individual will be free to give as many of those contributions to as many different candidates as they like.
And do you see that as being something that's going to affect a large proportion of candidates, for example, or is it going to be relatively small group of people we're talking about?
Oh, it certainly will be a small number of people who make the contributions. I actually don't think it's going to have a dramatic effect on candidates or elections here, because there were already so many ways for groups and political parties and other types of associations to spend what amounted to unlimited amounts of money on independent expenditures. And those gates had been opened through previous Supreme Court decisions. And so, if anything, it's possible to think about a positive effect of this is that there will be presumably more money coming into candidates where there's better disclosure, better ability to track those contributions. But the overall, if this has any effect, it will continue to increase the amount of money that is given to candidates.
Now, some critics here in Wisconsin have said that this could amount to money laundering, that you hit your limit for a particular candidate and then you give to a group and then they just funnel it back toward that candidate. Do you see that happening?
Well, there will probably be some things that look like that. Wisconsin law parallels fairly closely with the federal law in that regard, that you are not allowed to give money to a political committee or a political action committee with the expectation or understanding that they will turn around and give that money to an individual candidate. Now, the concern among campaign finance reform groups is that it's possible to communicate that or have that kind of understanding without anything being explicit. We'll see. I think there will be some concern about those sorts of things happening. But again, in many ways, this horse has already left the barn, that you can give $10,000 to Scott Walker or to Mary Burke and turn around and give an unlimited amount of money, millions of dollars, to a group, an outside group that is making independent expenditures on that election.
Do you think limits will remain on how much can be given to individual candidates here in Wisconsin?
Well, that's the big concern, that it's one of the last bulwarks of the original campaign finance regulation that extends back to the 1970s. So far, there are no indications that the Supreme Court is ready to explicitly consider that. But there are some indications, if you parse the language of McCutcheon carefully, there are some indications that they might be willing to entertain that, because if you consider the problem as one of solely corruption, the court seems to be open to an argument that a $2,000 or $2,500 or $2,600 contribution, if that's not corrupting, then why not $3,000 or $4,000 and $5,000? One thing that I think is very likely is that we will see somebody mount a challenge to that aspect of the law fairly soon. And whether or not it gets to the Supreme Court and is successful is obviously a different question. But I think we will see that coming down the pike at some point.
And what will this change mean, do you think, for the issue of transparency in political spending here in Wisconsin?
Well, there are already plenty of opportunities for people to obscure where the money is coming from. There are already lots of issues about groups that organize as tax-exempt groups, 501c3s and c4s, and their disclosure is different than it is for committees that are explicitly engaging in election express advocacy, independent expenditures. It's going to continue to be difficult. I think what will happen is we will see somewhat more money coming into candidates, but I really don't think it's going to diminish the amount that's going into these outside independent groups, in part because if you do that, it's somewhat easier to obscure where the money is ultimately coming from.
So how soon do you expect this to be in effect, the caps to be off in Wisconsin?
I would suspect that they'll be not enforced effective immediately, although it may be some time before it officially comes down as a formal rule. But I would imagine that as far as the GAB is concerned, that they are no longer in effect as of now.
As of now. All right, Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
We've been talking to Ken Mayer, political science professor at UW-Madison and an expert on campaign finance reform. Yesterday, Wisconsin election officials acknowledged that the state's aggregate campaign donations couldn't be upheld in light of the Supreme Court's decision along the same lines last month. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. The growing season is finally starting to pick up some steam around here, but some of the yummiest foods out there aren't growing in neat rows in your garden. Sometimes all you have to do is forage in the wild to find spring ingredients like ramps, morels, and watercress.
Here to give us a lesson in Foraging 101 is our regular food fanatic, Ian Knauer. Ian's the host of the PBS show The Farm and the author of a cookbook by the same name. He's also a farm-to-table chef who grows his own food in the family land in Pennsylvania. Ian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So, you know, we could be hitting the farmer's market and buying things, I guess, like ramps and morels and watercress, but you like to do it another way. You forage. What exactly do we mean when we talk about foraging?
Well, we basically mean that you wander through the woods looking for all these delicious things that grow wild in nature, and you're smart enough or educated enough to know which are the good ones and which are the not good ones, and then you can take those home and cook them up. In fact, ramps are a really good example. At my local farmer's market, I saw them last weekend for $30 a pound,
Ooh.
Which is really expensive. And they grow just about everywhere, all over the country, really, and they're free.
What about the state of foraging these days? You know, back in the 70s and 80s, there was some popular commercials and people sort of made fun of it in a fashion. But now it seems as though it's a serious pursuit and it seems as though more people are taking advantage of this.
Well, I think that stems from the real interest in the culture of food in this country, in American food culture. This is just a natural extension of that. You know, we're looking to artisan producers to make our bacons and our jellies and our jams. And we're looking to nature and everything that it supplies just, you know, in the wild. And you're right. It is. It used to be sort of this crazy thing that only wild people did. But now it's become really popular. And I think that's great.
So do we need special equipment to go out there foraging? What do we need when we're suiting up?
Well, the first thing that you want to keep in mind is that you will be walking through the woods. And all sorts of plants are starting to pop up this time of year, including poison ivy. So I would wear long pants and long socks and boots if you have them. Another thing to think about is that the ticks are starting to wake up, so put on some bug spray. And that way you're protected against the very common natural predators that are out there looking to eat you instead of you eating them.
So then once you're all dressed up, you're lubed up, you've got your tick protection on, you're out in the woods, how do you sort of train your eyes to look for what you need to find? Because, you know, if you're not used to this, you go out there and it's just a bunch of green stuff.
That's right. The first thing you want to do is you want to know what you're looking for. So there are some really great books out there on foraging. One just came out last year. It's called Foraged Flavor. It's written by a woman named Tama Wong. And she's actually a pretty famous forager. She supplies restaurants like Danielle in New York City with their wild greens. And she wrote this really wonderful book. It's very simple to follow. It's got great pictures, so you can, you know, take it with you and compare with what you find. But there are a lot of books out there. So I would start by finding out what it is that you want to look for and what it looks like. And then you want to figure out where those things grow. And, of course, what time of year they grow. So now, of course, we're in watercress season and ramp season and morel season. And some of those things have lookalikes that aren't quite the real thing. Like morels, there's such a thing as a false morel.
Hmm.
Ramps have actually a poisonous lookalike. Lily of the Valley looks a little bit like ramps. So you want to be able to look for the telltale signs that tell you just what the real thing is. And, of course, with ramps, it's pretty easy because they smell like onions. You know, you break them up and you sniff them, and it's pretty obvious that you found them when you found them. Morels are very pine cone, in shape, and the false nose looks sort of like a gnarly fist. So that's what you're looking for. Both those things are a very basic level of forager. You don't need to be, you don't have to have a master's degree in foraging to do pretty well with those two. And watercress is also quite easy to spot because it grows in water. So if you find a creek and it has some slow-moving water in it, that's where you would want to look for the watercress.
Well, I would be in heaven if I could find morels. You said there's this false morel to look out for. I think you said the false one looks like the gnarly fist?
That's correct, yeah. So the real one looks like this. Looks just like a morel. It's just this perfect little pine cone on top of a little hollow stem. Now, they grow singularly, which means there's one growing in each space, not two or three. They're not in clumps like some mushrooms. They grow on the forest floor, not on wood. But they also grow close to, and they really like, tulip poplar trees. Now, tulip poplars are easy to spot in the woods because they're very tall and they're very straight. So if you find yourself a cluster of tulip poplars, start looking around the base of those trees and nearby those trees for morels. I also find that it's actually much easier to spot them if you get down on your hands and knees and look horizontally, because then you'll see them, you know, a little forest of morels. And if you're looking down, they're really good at camouflaging. You know, it's funny. Mushroom foragers say that you forage for mushrooms, but you hunt for morels. They're a little bit harder to find, but once you find them, they're easy to identify.
But if you're rolling around on the forest floor, you're down there with the ticks and the poison ivy.
That's why you wear long clothing. And,
I guess so.
And put your bug spray on.
So this year here in Wisconsin, it's been pretty cool and kind of wet in the last couple of weeks. And how does the and I think our season here is behind in terms of where we might be for a normal year. How does that affect things like ramps and some of the other things we're talking about? Obviously, they're affected by the weather and by the seasons.
Of course, yeah. Wild crops are just as influenced by the climate as cultivated crops. So if you're a little cooler and you've had some rain, the rain is actually really good for all these things. And the cooler weather will slow it down a little bit. So as soon as you start to get some warmer days, that's when you want to start looking for this stuff. The ramps will take they'll be slow if it's cool, slow to grow if it's cool. And the morels just won't appear until it just gets a little warmer. You're looking for, you know, daytime temperatures in the high 50s, low 60s.
So let's say we find what we're looking for. We find our ramps. We find our morels. What do we need to know about how to pick it and then to store it so that it's, you know, still in good shape when we get it home to cook with it?
So each one of these has its own little quirks and characteristics. The watercress, for instance, I like to clip off the top of it, leaving the roots in the water and in the mud, and then put that in a plastic bag with a little bit of the water from the creek. That keeps it very crisp and fresh, and you know you have no chance of it spoiling on your trip home. The ramps, the best way to cut the ramps is to dig down maybe an inch or so, and then cut them with a pair of kitchen shears. Now you want to be careful not to take the rhizome, the root rhizome, with you because that's what brings the next year's ramp crop back. And so you'll have the green leaves and part of the stalk for the ramps. We'll come back to that in just a second because I want to tell you more about the rhizome. But the ramps, you can put them in a plastic bag. And then the morels, you want to cut them off where they meet the ground. And for mushrooms, you want to put them in a paper bag because they like to breathe a little bit. So that's how you would want to harvest them and get them home. But going back to those ramp rhizomes, if you ever see ramps at the farmer's market, and they have some root on them, buy them and then take those roots, cut off the roots, use the rest of the ramp to cook with, and plant those roots because that rhizome will continue to produce ramps. And so you can then find a nice shaded place in the forest. They like to be near hardwood trees like oak trees and plant them near the base of a hardwood tree. And there's a pretty good chance if the conditions are right that they'll come back year after year for you.
So you can actually grow your own ramps, kind of cultivate them. That's cool.
Yeah, and it's sort of a myth that you can't cultivate them. You definitely can. I have for several years now.
And so, Ian, in our last minute here, I know you've got a special place in your heart for ramps, and you've included a ramp recipe for us to try out. What do you love about ramps, and what is in your ramp recipe?
Well, the thing that I love about ramps is not the fact that you can only get them for a few weeks a year. I wish that we could get them all year long. But it's the fact that they have a very unique onion flavor. They're not like an onion, they're not like a leek, they're not like a garlic. There's some combination of those three things, and they also have a real beautiful sweetness to them that comes out when you cook the leaves. So flavor-wise, I think they're probably one of my favorite flavors in the onion family. And cooking them, you can cook them like you would use anything from a scallion to an onion to garlic to leeks. You can roast them, you can sauté them, you can puree them. And they really give a beautiful, gentle, oniony sweetness to whatever you put them in.
And we've got your recipe for ramp pasta with some cream and lots of other luscious stuff up on our Facebook page. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you guys.
That was Ian Knauer, host of the PBS show The Farm and the author of a cookbook by the same name.
And don't forget, you can check out his wild ramp pasta recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.